You may be seated. The next case is 2024-30668, Taylor, United States versus Taylor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Allison Mills on behalf of Blair Taylor. After Blair Taylor was acquitted, the same prosecutor prosecuted him for the same crime. She, the prosecutor, could not do that here, not constitutionally. There are two constitutional problems. One is double jeopardy, the other is due process. Either way, the error is plain. Existing case law plainly anticipated it. But before I get to the law for each of those points, I want to summarize the facts because the facts are straightforward and there is no factual dispute. There were three criminal trials here. The first trial in state court ended in conviction. That conviction was vacated on appeal, so there was a retrial. The retrial was the second trial. That second trial ended in acquittal. That should have ended things, and acquittal usually ends things, but not here. Here, the same prosecutor who prosecuted Mr. Taylor in the first trial, then an ADA, now an AUSA, turned around and indicted him again for the same thing in federal court, the same crime. And so let me explain the same crime.
Also explain how you got rid of the acquittal.
How we got rid of the acquittal?
How it wasn't controlling once it went back.
Oh, okay. Well, the first trial was conviction.
Right.
Appealed. It was a non-unanimous jury, and so under Ramos,
okay,
it was vacated.
Right.
Second trial was the retrial. That ended in an acquittal.
Maybe you haven't answered Judge Clement's question.
Did that answer your question? Yeah. Thank you.
What case says that it's plain error to not, when it's in a different sovereign? I think the 11th Circuit has said, when with two sovereigns, the possibility of institutional bias is minimized. And so what case says that this is plain error?
Well, I'll get there, but two sovereigns presumes two independent decision makers. And you do not have two independent decision makers when the same person makes the charging decision. And I'm definitely going to get to that law.
Shouldn't that be the most important thing to get to?
Well, I'll get there right now.
Okay.
I'll just make this point because there's no factual dispute that there was only one decision maker here. There was only one decision maker. It was Inga Petrovich.
She's the prosecutor.
The same person.
The same person is the prosecutor for the state and then for the federal government. But it's two sovereigns. And so the other circuits have held that where there's two sovereigns, the possibility of institutional bias is minimized. And so you need to say what case would say that where it's two sovereigns but the same prosecutor is plain error.
Yes, Judge Elrod, and what you were referring to there is vindictiveness, institutional bias. That goes to due process. I will address first, if it's okay, double jeopardy. There are two lenses here, and however you look at it, through whichever lens, you end up at the same place. I'll start with double jeopardy, and then we'll probably spend more time on due process. So I'll get double jeopardy out of the way.
Okay, case says that it's double jeopardy that you would, because you have to establish plain error.
Yes.
And so you have to satisfy prong two, right?
Yes.
So you have to give, usually in order to establish prong two, you have to give an example. You don't 100% have to have a case, but 90% of the time, most of the time, you have to have a case. So what case says it's double jeopardy for two different sovereigns, even with the same prosecutor?
The case that I will talk about today for that is Angleton. And I'll begin. Of course, double jeopardy says you can't prosecute the same defendant for the same crime twice. But courts have held that that does not apply to two different sovereigns. That is the dual sovereignty doctrine. And I'm not going to argue today that the doctrine is invalid. It does have a lot of criticism, but my argument is not that the doctrine is invalid, it is that it does not apply here. And Angleton supports that. The reason is the dual sovereignty doctrine is premised on, it presumes, two independent decision makers, two independent sovereigns, two independent decisions. The key is independence. The doctrine was never meant to protect what happened here. It was never meant to allow a single prosecutor to retry a defendant she already lost to. This court said that in Angleton. In Angleton, this court said the doctrine turns on, and I quote, whether the separate sovereigns have made independent decisions to prosecute or whether instead, the state and federal prosecutor are the same person, end quote. So in other words, the doctrine does not apply when the state and federal prosecutor are, quote, the same person. When they are the same person, you lack, quote, independent decisions.
What was the result in Angleton?
Well, Angleton, different facts. In Angleton, you did not have the same prosecutor. So the court in Angleton said, no double jeopardy problem. The court in Angleton said, however, you might have a problem with these facts, these exact same facts that we have here. And the court cited a case, the Belcher case, out of the Western District of Virginia. In Belcher, which is just like this case, the state prosecutor charged the defendant with manufacturing marijuana, but the state court dismissed the indictment. Okay? The state prosecutor, now acting as an AUSA, turns around, charges the same guy again for the same thing in federal court. And the federal court says, you can't do that. You couldn't have done this in state court. You can't do that here. The same prosecutor can't do that. Belcher is just like this case, with one exception. The prosecutor in Belcher was acting as a state prosecutor and an AUSA at the exact same time, simultaneously. Now, the government says, well, that's dispositive. But it's not. The prosecutor was still the same person. That's Angleton's word, same person.
What's your best case for the idea that an AUSA is the sovereign of the United States, right? I mean, if you know anything about the way that the federal prosecutor's offices work, right? Their teams, there's political accountability, mm-hmm. there's the Deputy Attorney General's office and Main Justice. Charging decisions, as far as I'm aware, are not made by a single individual prosecutor. So what is the relevance of the fact that the assistant district attorney left that office, moved to a different office? Is the allegation that she made this charging decision in a vacuum by herself and that AUSAs in that particular division are allowed to bring murder charges without review from anyone?
That's a great question. I don't have a case that answers the question, but it goes to, could the government have rebutted the presumption that she made this decision here by herself? And oftentimes the government does. In fact, when I get to the vindictiveness argument, I'll show that the government does that pretty easily, and the presumption that the decision was an interested decision, that it was vindictive, falls apart. But that didn't happen here.
Well, it didn't happen here because the lawyer didn't challenge this.
And that is our ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And I know that you rarely reach that on the merits in a direct appeal. I think you could reach it here on this record, but in any event, if you do not, of course, we would hope to preserve that issue for post-conviction review.
But so just to be clear, you do not actually have a case where a conviction was held to be double jeopardy or vindictive on under these circumstances. You have some cases that you put together and argue by analogy. Is that correct?
Well, Belcher is this case. Belcher is this case, and this court Angleton.
Belcher was simultaneous.
And I'll address why simultaneous doesn't matter, that's not dispositive. The prosecutor was the same person, period. He didn't become somebody else because he wore two hats. Whether the prosecutor here, Inga Petrovich,
wore one hat, took it off, and then put on another hat, or whether instead she wore two hats simultaneously, she is still just one person. She's the same person. The costume does not make the decision independent. She was not disinterested. And that's why the case law refers to the same person. I'll turn quickly now, since I'm running out of time, to due process. The due process lens is this. The Fifth Amendment prohibits prosecutions that are vindictive. Courts presume a prosecution is vindictive when the only explanation for it is the defendant successfully appealed, successfully set aside the conviction. The presumption applies here. Blair Taylor exercised his rights successfully after Petrovic indicted him in federal court. Those are the only facts we have. The government had no reason, has not offered any reason to re-prosecute Blair Taylor other than he set aside his conviction. On these facts, without more, the law presumes vindictiveness, but it's just a presumption. It can be rebutted. All the government has to do is point to facts which suggest it had a different independent reason for re-indicting. But the government didn't do that here. Now, case law tells us what the government should have and could have done. And these are the government's own cases.
So the government is supposed to do this whenever there's no argument being made at all. It's just supposed to jump out and say, oh, we have a response to vindictiveness here, but no one's arguing vindictiveness. What would have been the incentive or the appropriateness of the government to make an argument that no one would... It's a defensive argument, so why would they raise it on their own sua sponte?
And that gets back to ineffective assistance of counsel, and Blair Taylor's counsel should have raised this issue below. But the government, I'll explain through other cases what the government does in these situations when you have a state prosecutor who becomes an AUSA. United States v. Graham, it's an Eighth Circuit case cited by the government. The defendant in Graham set aside a state court conviction after the same prosecutor indicted him in federal court for essentially the same charges, okay? Presumption of vindictiveness. But the government rebutted the presumption by showing that, in fact, the decision to prosecute in federal court had been made before the appeal was decided. Okay? So that took care of things. Another case, United States v. Rivera, Fourth Circuit, also cited by the government. Rivera successfully appealed a state court conviction for murder, just like here. On retrial, he was acquitted, just like here. After the state prosecutor became an AUSA, just like here, and he was indicted again. But the government rebutted any presumption there by showing that the state prosecutor was not involved at all in the decision to indict. And in fact, the supervisor plainly instructed the state prosecutor who had become the AUSA, hey, you can't be involved in that case. So the government knows how to handle these things. That just didn't happen here. And so we are left simply with a presumption of vindictiveness, no rebuttal, and that's a due process problem.
If you were to win on that, the remedy you would get is a double jeopardy declaration from us, and the case would be over, right? Your
yes.
client would walk.
Well, or vindictiveness, due process or double jeopardy, yes.
Right. What do you think about the incentives that would create for this sort of litigation going forward? Because the best possible way, like the best solution for you, is to not raise it, not give the government a chance to do all of the things you just said. Come to us for the first time, raise it on plain error, and win victory for your client. That would create quite a carrot, should we say, for future litigants in your situation.
I follow you. I think that a lawyer who sees this kind of issue will raise it.
Why?
I would argue
the other thing. I think if you're right, that you've done it exactly the best possible way, right? Because you have a presumption with no opportunity to rebut, you win the end. QED.
If you have a client who is acquitted and is being retried for the same crime, you would raise this issue, in my opinion, rather than risk conviction and having to overturn it on appeal. I believe that a competent lawyer representing a criminal defendant would raise this issue. So I do not believe that, I follow your argument, but I do not believe that a ruling in our favor here, would actually incentivize that. And I will answer any questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Elrod, may I proceed?
Yes, you may.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kevin Boydman for the United States. Your Honors, there's no reason to call into question the federal prosecution which occurred after a state court acquittal in this matter. Well-established precedent establishes that the dual sovereignty doctrine allows the federal government to prosecute Blair Taylor in this matter for a murder under federal laws, even though it was the same act that was the subject under the state's laws. To the contrary, no precedent supports, especially on plain error review, a finding that the federal prosecution was vindictive solely because AUSA Inga Petrovich had, when she was previously a state assistant district attorney, prosecuted Blair Taylor in one of the trials. The court should affirm this matter. Just to quickly clarify some things, opposing counsel talked about the facts and the timing. I do want to clarify the timing matter here. The act occurred, Blair Taylor's shootings occurred in 2014. Inga Petrovich was one of the assistant DAs who tried the case in state court at the 2017 trial and obtained the conviction. In 2019, Ms. Petrovich left the office, became an AUSA. In 2020, after the Supreme Court's decision in Ramos, the Louisiana courts vacate. It then goes back to the state for retrial. Two separate assistant district attorneys tried the retrial. Ms. Petrovich was not part of that. She was already at the federal government, so she was not part of the retrial. After the acquittal at that point, the federal government was brought the indictment, and Ms. Petrovich was part of the trial team at that point, one of the prosecutors who indicted the case and one of the prosecutors who tried it. And I think that timing is important because there is a separation here. This is not something where something was vindictive at the start or vindictive because Mr. Taylor exercised his right to a state appeal. Indeed, the state retried after that. So it had nothing to do with that. When it comes to the vindictiveness, I do also disagree with opposing counsel that there's a case here that presumes vindictiveness. I don't read Graham and Rivera the same way as holding that the facts of those cases actually established a presumption of vindictiveness. I believe as the Eighth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, that for purposes of argument, they assumed prosecutorial vindictiveness without addressing that question, but decided that if it was there, the government had rebutted it. But I think, so I don't think those cases control, and I don't think those are examples of presumptions of vindictiveness requiring the government to rebut anything, especially as I think many you judges have pointed out, on plain error review where the record is not developed below and there's really no chance to rebut except by going outside the record. But I don't think you
have... If we did not reach, just assuming arguendo, that we did not reach the ineffectiveness claim and that were to be pursued, the government would have an opportunity, if it got past a certain threshold, to explain why it didn't matter and give all of those reasons, wouldn't it?
Yes, most likely in a 2255 proceeding, assuming, as you said,
assuming it got past all the threshold steps to that. That would be where it would be explained, and then the court could evaluate.
At this point in the procedure, I think that would be the only thing to go forward. Of course, I don't think you need to go there because I think a look at the case law here, the precedent, or the absence of precedent, especially here, on plain error, but really even under understanding any standard of error, does not support vindictiveness here. The vindictiveness cases, if you look at going to Goodwin in some of the cases it talks about, and within this circuit, Lakesy, and then in the other circuit, Rivera, also within this circuit, the Johnson case, to obtain a presumption of vindictiveness, there has to be a showing of a realistic likelihood of vindictiveness. And just the allegation itself is not important. That's important to remember here because what Taylor is calling objective evidence of vindictiveness is nothing more than speculation. It is simply Inga Petrovich was a state assistant DA at one time, Inga Petrovich was a federal AUSA at one time, tried the same person. Therefore, it must be vindictive. What else could it possibly be? I think the standard for getting a presumption of vindictiveness and requiring the government to respond needs to be more than that. We cited the Seventh Circuit case of, if I said it right, Hideki, and they make a point of saying you can't just have something like that for several reasons, including the need to protect open and frank conversations between prosecutors and state and federal partners, protect the government from harassment and delay and unnecessary filings by criminal defendants, and unnecessary irrelevant massive discovery that could start following.
What sort of evidence are you envisioning?
I think there would need to be some kind of colorable claim, more than just prosecutor here, prosecutor there. Something else that shows there is some kind of intent to do something, not just punish for criminal behavior, but as the case law says, punish the defendant for doing something the law plainly allows him.
But where am I going to, if there's no discovery, there's no harassing litigation, as you say, we're not doing this in 2255, what is there? What are you looking for? Some statement made to the press? Like, what would be the thing that would, if it's not just the identity of a prosecution.
I think you mentioned the statement in the press. I think that's certainly something that could. I think possibly statements that come in pleadings, maybe statements that come in motions. But
let me ask you this. Sure. Imagine, let's push a little bit on the identity of the prosecutors. There's three prosecutors in state court, A, B, and C.
Okay.
They lose.
Sure.
They then move over to the U.S. Attorney's Office. One is the AUSA, one is the FAC, the first assistant, and the next is the U.S. Attorney, appointed by the President, confirmed by the Senate. They bring the same challenge. Yes or no, double jeopardy problem.
The best I can say without, based on the limits of your hypothetical, Judge Oldham, is it's a closer case. But even then,
you can't give me that one.
I can't give you that for this reason, because as you pointed out, the department itself, as you know, has checks and balances in place. There are presumptions of regularity. Even in that situation, under the department's Pettit policy, the attorneys who came from the state office and now are the top three in the U.S. attorneys would still be bound by that to send that up to the Assistant Attorney General's office for them to sign off. So there is another decision maker. Even if those three wanted to do it, it still has to go somewhere else for that final decision maker. And that actually gets back to Judge Elrod, I think your point or the question you were making about who is the decision maker. And the key is not the identity of the prosecutor. The key is the identity of the sovereign. And the sovereign is the United States. And in that, in your hypo, Judge Oldham, certainly the U.S. attorney would be one of the top. And that's why I'm saying it's closer, but there is still a top level on there in the department.
So it is realistically impossible, in your view, to use the double jeopardy clause to impose any sort of prohibition on using a state court trial as a dry run. I mean, it's almost impossible for a federal court or the double jeopardy clause to prevent the nightmare scenario, which is that a prosecution team basically uses it as a moot court in a law firm conference room.
I'm not going to say it's impossible because the situation you're bringing up there is using as a dry run obviously starts bringing in the sham prosecution exceptions, possible exceptions apart, as you know, this and Angleton talks about it. It's obviously never been fully accepted. But in those situations, again, I'm not saying discovery is off as a matter of course. I think like any other case, same with the Franks Delaware evidentiary hearing, there needs to be some kind of basis for the allegation you're making, more than just an allegation that I win.
What are the policies, do we know, you may not know, in this particular district or in the from Maine Justice about if you come over and you've prosecuted somebody, what are the backstops?
I'm going outside the record, but I'm not, having been in my district now for 21 years.
Right, you're very experienced, right. And so I thought you might know.
Sure, I'm not aware of anything that would say just because you came from that state, from the state court, you're barred from that. And I think there's some good reasons for that, Your Honor. One, first, it's not uncommon, as your hypothetical points are, right, for state assistant district attorneys to become federal AUSAs at some point. In this district especially, it's a big district, but it's a small district too. Defendants recidivate. People stay prosecutors a good amount of time. It's not improbable that you're going to see the same person or have prior knowledge of someone. And I don't think it's a bad thing to have someone involved in that case. In fact, I think it's good for the government to do that. And you look at a case like this, where clearly very egregious, heinous situation, shooting spree, Two people are dead. One is a teenager. A mother is shot. Three minors are shot. A four-year-old is shot in the eyes and rendered blind. A two-year-old shot in the head. As you can imagine, that's a lot of things to put together, dealing with witnesses, law enforcement, and victims. And so if you have a prosecutor who handled it in state court, and conviction or acquittal comes over here and that case is prosecuted for the same act under federal law, I think it would almost be negligence, if not malpractice, for the government to want someone with that kind of knowledge, with a relationship with law enforcement, victim, and witnesses to be part of that trial, so that the victims especially don't have to go through something again, or witnesses don't have to...
So you don't think they need to be walled off for any kind of reasoning? It's different than for a judge. You know, if I was a judge in Harris County, a very large district, and I had a case as a judge, and then I came to the federal system, and it's on habeas, I wouldn't be ruling on that same case, and also I wouldn't be ruling if it was a federal case arising out of that. The ethical rules for us, we would say, no, we shouldn't sit on that case.
Right, and I agree it would be different, and I think the key thing comes back to the basic point of dual sovereignty is what you elicited. As the judge, you're the decision maker. As the line prosecutor, the line prosecutor is not. There's something else. There's a separate sovereign that's involved, and that's where I think, and also the prosecution of a different code, the same act, but different code, different elements. And even if they were identical, as the court knows, it would still be a different offense. So I think that's the reason there isn't that. Now, if there would be something possible, some kind of ethical violation that happened at one than the other, I think fact specific, but as think is it that could be best handled by a wall off. But as a general matter, I don't think so. And I think that also comes back, and that's because the sovereignty issue is one of the defining things. And I think it's also important because that really shows, I think, why the rule that opposing counsel's argument here suggests is really untenable. Because if you take the argument point blank, it really is anytime you have the two prosecutors, the one prosecutor in both jurisdictions, even though they're at different time, that's per se vindictive, per se presumption. That would be a problem. And Belcher, I disagree that that stands for that process. And I realize in Angleton quoted the sentence from Belcher that said, except when the prosecutor is the same person. But even in Angleton, about a couple of paragraphs above that, it talks about the two prosecuting entities and deriving powers to prosecute from independent sources. So just as the Supreme Court did in the Dinesby case, if you read that sentence in isolation, that quote from Belcher in isolation, it might be favorable to Taylor. But if you read it in context, it's not. Because while Taylor doesn't think the simultaneous power matters, that's exactly what matters. It was the fact in Belcher that the county attorney was a special AUSA, wearing the same hats at the same time, simultaneously deriving power from both at one time. That's what the district court in Belcher found to be the problem, and that's the language, that's the quote that ended up in Angleton.
Of course, under your theory, that's irrelevant. Like, Belcher has to be wrong, right?
We don't agree that Belcher is necessarily accurate. I do agree that the Fifth Circuit cited Belcher favorably, so I'm not pressing that. But if this is an opportunity to say whether Belcher is the law, I don't think it is. But even if it is, even if that is the case, and even if that's what Angleton adopted by citing it, that's not what you have here. This was not one instance where Ms. Petrovich had the hats of the state of Louisiana and the hat of the United States on at the same time. There were years in between.
But why would that matter? Same case, same facts. Presumably she has access to the same information, same files. Like, why would it matter if she had been? I mean, if you take for, mm-hmm. I understand why it's a district court decision. It's not from our circuit. Why would it matter if she was in both offices at the same time versus being the same case of the same files separated by?
And I'm not saying it does. I'm not saying I agree with Belcher.
But you're just looking for a way to distinguish it.
Yeah, I am distinguishing because it was favorably cited in Angleton. I can't tell you that your court has not adopted it at this point. And I'll also say that question came up in Graham, in the Eighth Circuit case, where that prosecutor was wearing them also both at the same time, but still was able to rebut any presumption that may have occurred. So I don't think it's correct, but even if it is, you don't have it here for that reason. And I think, again, that's the reason why the rule is untenable. If any time the allegation is made and we get a per se presumption of vindictiveness, as you pointed out, especially in plain error review, the government is really in a trick bag. But also, that rule ignores the longstanding presumptions of regularity in the DOJ protocols, including the Pettit policy. It also doesn't account for state action by other assistant DAs. The fact that Inga Petrovich was not the only state attorney on the case, there were others. She was one of others. The rule also doesn't have a limitation. In this case, Inga Petrovich was the trial attorney. But the rule Taylor basically asks isn't limited to that. What about a state prosecutor in the screening department who just signs the charging document? What about a state prosecutor who just stands in for someone else on one occasion? What about a state prosecutor who's not involved in the prosecution team but has advice? At what point is this? There's no limitation principle to the argument that's being made here, and that's another problem why the rule is untenable, besides the dual sovereignty doctrine, and besides the fact that it's very hard to find vindictiveness in separate cases. In case the Supreme Court has noted, the successful vindictive cases have been by the same sovereign, and that's because when things went bad, the prosecutor upped the ante and upped the penalty. That just doesn't exist here. The other thing is, as you pointed out here, by making the argument in plain error only, the burden, which is under plain error on the defense, would get shifted to the government to rebut a presumption. That doesn't seem to be the right way to do things on plain error review. So for those reasons, we don't think there's a finding of vindictiveness for well-established law, which is probably now, as the Gamble Court says, at least 170 to nearly 180 years old. The fact that the federal government prosecuted Taylor after the state acquittal does not violate the double jeopardy. And because I think the case law is so clear on that, I think you could dispose of the ineffective assistance argument by saying there is no ineffectiveness because you're not ineffective for failing to bring a meritless claim. But at the very least, if you don't go there, that would be a 2255 argument. Unless there are any other questions from the court, we would just ask you to affirm the conviction below.
Thank you. We have your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I heard Mr. Boitman say that, as a matter of policy, essentially, the state prosecutor who tried the case ought to try the case in federal court, too, because otherwise it would be a waste of those resources. But what he's calling for is essentially a super sovereign. I mean, the state and the federal governments are merged in one person. That is precisely the concern in Belcher, and this court cited Belcher approvingly in Angleton. What he is describing is not federalism. He's describing a central government. And as to, well, there's no limitation, you know, if we accept her argument, think of all the other cases. Actually, this case is not a gray case at all. It's not a case in which the state prosecutor merely assisted in a subsequent federal prosecution. That's not this case. In this case, the state prosecutor signed the federal indictment, gave the opening statement, made the closing argument. It is the same person. There is no other decision maker here. The law requires an independent decision maker, and the government doesn't even purport to have one. I also heard that there's no Fifth Circuit precedent for applying a presumption in a case like this. Two cases, United States v. DeVorin, United States v. Cresdorn. Both of those cases we cite in our brief. In both of those cases, after an appeal, the prosecutor comes back, tags on another charge, does something different. The presumption of vindictiveness applied in that case too. Those cases too. My question is, would Petrovich have retried Blair Taylor in federal court if he had not set aside the state court conviction? No, he would be in jail. But if she had a reason for doing it, all the government has to do is point to it, and the presumption falls away. But they don't have a reason, or we'll find out maybe whether they have a reason. The bottom line, again, is whichever lens you look through, whether it's double jeopardy or due process, you end up at the same place. Same prosecutor, same crime, re-prosecution after a successful appeal and acquittal, no independence, no independent decision maker, no independent reason. Plainness is measured against settled principles, the principle that one decision maker cannot supply two independent judgments is not novel. We ask you to vacate, and if not, preserve our ineffective assistance of counsel claim for post-conviction review. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mills. And we note that you are court appointed, and we appreciate your argument today, as we appreciate also the argument of the government. And thank you both, and the case is submitted.